Hi everyone, welcome to another episode of the Cheeky Natives. It's your boy Letlo Honolo flying solo. Alma's making her way to the Open Book Festival, and you know, we'll get to hear more about what her experience of the Open Book Festival is. But mine personally has been absolutely amazing. And today we're going to be speaking to, I mean, a book that I think everyone should have in their libraries. Like, I honestly, I'm not even lying. I'm just like, go pick it up after you listen to this episode. We'll be speaking to the author of Friday Black. So, Nana Kwame Ajebrian was born in 1991 and is of Ghanaian-American descent. He graduated from Sunny Alburn and went to receive his MFA at Sir Cruz University. His work has appeared or is forthcoming in numerous publications, including The Print Row and The Breakwater Review, where he was selected as ZZ Pack as the winner of the second annual Breakwater Review Fiction Prize. Friday Black is his first book. And before we start, hi Nana.
Hey, how are you doing? What's going on? I'm okay.
I mean, before we start, I want to know, is this your first time in South Africa?
It is my first time in South Africa. It's my first time on the continent.
Oh, wow.
And so it's kind of like a big deal for me, actually, be here. And I feel pretty honored to get to be here, so absolutely.
And how has Open Book Festival been for you?
It's been beautiful, you know. I've done a couple of festivals, and the vibe here is it just feels very alive and energetic. It's very diverse in multiple senses. I see so many young people really engaged with the reading, which feels very, you know, important for me, and that's great. But yeah, I've met a ton of people, a ton of great authors, great journalists, and it's been like kind of just fun all around for me.
Yeah. Before we start, I'd like you to read a short story from your collection before we get into the meat of the conversation.
Okay. This story is called Things My Mother Said. It's about things my mother said. That's like the joke I usually tell. But you know, just to like situate it, I guess, just a little bit. I was born in America. I was born in New York. And so my mother's a Ghanaian immigrant. And for a long time, she was saying the things I wanted her to say, but I didn't understand it exactly. And so I think this story is a lot about me sort of growing up, kind of getting to realize, oh, even back then, you know, everything I needed was there. I just maybe couldn't hear it. Things my mother said. My mother's favorite thing to say to me was, I am not your friend. She'd often say, you are my firstborn son, my only son, as a reminder not to die. She loved saying as a way to keep me humble, I didn't have a mother. You're lucky. You have a mother. When the TV went dark, my mother said, good, now you can read more. Then our house at the bottom of the hill lost all its life. Gas, water, electric. One day I came home to the warm smell of chicken and rice. I hadn't been able to steal a second burger in the cafeteria at school that day. My stomach whined. At home, the fridge had become a casket bearing nothing. The range and oven had become decorations meant to make a dying box look like a home. Hunger colored those days. Where's this from? I asked, already carving out a healthy portion from a worn gray pot. My mother pretended she didn't hear me. She was studying the pages of her massive white Bible at the kitchen table. Wide sheets of light pressed through the window and draped her. She spent her days reading that big Bible. Its pages wore to film as her fingers fluttered from psalm to psalm. She'd be asleep by the splash of dusk. I, on the other hand, would be up for hours, trying to do homework by the blue glow of my cell phone, clinging to its light until it died. At night, hunger and I huddled together. I fall asleep thinking, one day I would change everything. That afternoon, I ate the chicken and rice. It tasted like pepper and smoke. How did you make this, Mom? I asked again. She looked up from her Bible. Oh, my dear. Did you pray over your food? Did you say your psalms today? I ate the food quickly, greedily. I chewed the bones till they splintered in my mouth. Another thing my mother often said. You are the best thing that ever happened to me. Later, when I was in the backyard, hesitant to return to the dying box as the sun dipped away, I found a patch of charred grass and a small circle of blackened stones and pebbles, an ash moon branded into a sea of wild green grass. I touched a gray rock, partially blackened by flame, to see if it was still hot. I felt proud and ashamed. For the record, I know I was lucky. I know I am lucky. I don't think you're stupid. I know I'm not your friend. I hope you can be proud of me.
Thank you so much. So I mean it's a great way to start. I feel the dedication of the book. It says, for my mother who said, how can you be bored? Mm-hmm. How many books have you written?
Direct bars from her.
And I think it's an interesting way to start the conversation. So you dedicate the book to your mom. You also write a short story to your mom. And what role has your mother played in your life in terms of, you know, giving you this literature and talking to you about the importance of literature? Because we understand African parents are always telling us about the importance of education.
Yeah, my mom herself was an educator. She's a teacher. She was a teacher. And so my whole life, like, education has never been like an option. It's always been like the default that you're gonna pursue. If your grades aren't good, you're gonna feel it physically in your body. And that's like a nice way of saying that. You will feel it physically, you know. That's the nicest way of saying that. But you know, she was, you know, just a constant source of like encouragement one way or another. And again, sometimes it was sort of harsh for me, it sounded like. But yeah, she was huge on that. And both of my parents were. And so it's been, you know, I had to dedicate my first book to her. I think especially just kind of because of when I was younger, I didn't take it. I took it for granted, I think. You know, you kind of like that your mom is a person. You don't understand sort of the journey she's been on to get there and like how much sort of has been poured into you for you to have a chance to be the person that you are. And so, yeah, I had to like, I had like some explicit dedications to her throughout the book, yeah.
So, you know George Saunders.
Yeah. This has been a thing. I texted him about how like he's a big deal in South Africa. Did I tell you that? I texted him after the fact. I was like, so like you're like a big deal here. And he was like, people think it's crazy. I didn't realize that like everyone loves him here too, you know?
Yeah.
He's the most popular person everywhere. But yeah, he was like, I said, you're a big deal in South Africa. People are very excited that I know you here. He said, that's awesome. You're really seeing the world, you know? And then he said something nice about
it. I mean, look, the short story form is like a very, I mean, in the South African context, it's a form that is not appreciated as much. And I wanted to know, like, what did it feel like being under the mentorship of like someone we consider a genius in terms of short story?
Yeah, I don't think it's appreciated on our side either. You know, it really isn't. But the good thing about George is, you see, or at least having him very close and being like some, having him personally kind of mentor you is like, first off, he's just a very, very like considerate craftsperson. But more than that, he's just a nice guy, you know. I think the thing he's helped me in my life has been bigger than the stuff he's helped me with in my fiction, just in terms of like offering by example ways of kind of moving through the world. I'm especially grateful now I am in, not in his position, but in a position that, you know, to speak to people about being a writer. To have him as an example has been great. But no, he's super kind, but he also goes into stories in his workshop. He's really good at like breaking them down, like reverse engineering a story into like manageable pieces, almost like a mechanic.
Yeah.
And he does so though in a way that like, that sounds like, as someone whose stories are so full of heart, his, I mean, it seems like, you know, it wouldn't be like that, but no, like you can do that. And another very, very important lesson he gave me was that a story, like the big problems of a story, the big emotional, intellectual, philosophical problems of the story are solved on a sentence level. And that is like kind of freeing, because sometimes you're writing these stories that are about these big important ideas and kind of like you can kind of almost cower under the magnitude of the sort of task.
Yeah.
But when you realize, wait, just make, if it's ringing off wrong emotionally or even philosophically, it means your sentences are wobbly. And that attitude, which he says that's the thing he has given me like explicitly, it helps I think, a writer go into any situation a little bit more confidently, because you know what? It's hard to solve, like, the problems of, like, the human heart and world hunger, but, like, just getting the sentence, or whatever the issue may be, but just getting the sentence down, I think that's been a great, that's been a super helpful idea for me to have and to carry, and he gave me that, I think.
Look, I mean, this is your debut collection, and it's been doing extremely well. You know, you've got Colson, who's, like, named you, he gave the award of 30 under 35, right?
Yeah.
5 under 35.
Yep.
And how is that? Like, I mean, first book, and already it's doing so incredibly well.
I mean, like, if I think about it too much directly, I get, like, anxiety, like, become an anxiety machine and explode into that. But it is very, 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 it's an honor. If I was telling another author literally, like, a couple hour ago, because we were talking about this, like, those kind of people. If I had to choose five people that are alive in the world, let's say five or six, four of them have, like, engaged with my work and, like, done something nice for me already. That's ZZ Packer, Roxane Gay, Colson Whitehead, and George Saunders. Like, it's for me personally, it helps me move in, like, a different kind of confidence, because to have that before you really start, that acknowledgement came almost before the book was really out, even though we didn't announce it until later on.
Yeah.
But to have that acknowledgement, it's like, you know what, I am doing this thing, you know, I am here, I am doing it. And he was actually the first black male author I ever saw in physical form.
Yeah.
As, like, undergrad in college.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking, like, oh, like, this guy's, like, smart, you know, like, and thinking, like, wow, maybe, like, you know, it was almost intimidating, because, yeah, you know, if you ever heard him speak, he just knows, he's just, like, a brilliant ass guy. And then, so to have some acknowledgement like someone like him, it's just a big deal for me. And then, but then, same thing goes for George, even though he was my professor. Same thing goes, like, for people like Roxane Gay, who I've never met. So it's just been a blessing, and it's kind of hard to comprehend it, that it's real, actually. But, and the fact that I'm even in South Africa right now, sometimes I'm like, is it real, or, you know?
So I wanted to talk about the title of the book and why the decision was made to call it Friday Black.
So, with just in terms of transparency, my publishers forced me to choose a different title than I was going to originally choose. But we settled on Friday Black because I think, first off, it just, like, sounded, like, kind of punchier. It's a little bit darker than what it would have been. And it also kind of has that sense of, like, something that's familiar but then also strange, something a little bit different, a little bit off-kilter, a little flipped on its head. And so for me, that ended up being an important idea to convey with the title.
And I said this to you in the panel that we were together, that the book sounds like a track. It just seems, yeah, like it's a musical, and I wanted to know why the form took the form it did.
Yeah, I really, when you said that, you know, that's super, like, it resonates with me a lot, because it was overtly considered that way. That is, like, sort of like a track list for, like, a project, like an album. And for me, I just, it's just, like, kind of about intentionality. I like the idea of, like, the importance of not working when I listen to, like, an album, like, say that's the epigraph is a quote by Kendrick Lamar, and then from a song that's actually from Schoolboy Q's album, but it's Kendrick Lamar quote. And I think about an album like Good Kid, Mad City, and how intentionally sequenced it was, you know. And so when you're writing a book, especially a collection of short stories, or really any book, the order in which you give the information to your readers, it matters. It's an important decision. And so the order in which I sort of presented these stories, it's kind of like, it really informs what kind of book it will be, and or at least the way it will emerge in people's memories and minds. And so I tried to be very intentional about the way I ordered it, and the first track or story, you know, like, what is that going to be? And that's always going to have just an important, it's always going to be a big deal, you know. The first is always going to be something huge, and some people go straight to the last story, you know. So again, it's like, I was thinking about all the way through, giving, like, a sort of sense of
you know, rising and falling and I don't know, feeling like something's accumulated by the time you get to the end. Also making these very disparate, in my case, very stories that might not even exist in the same plane of existence feel as though they are together.
Yeah.
You know, so that's all important for me.
And I mean, I think you do something absolutely brilliant with the book, right? So what you do is you have these stories which are fiction, but in some instances seem really autobiographical. So there's this site of memory, there's a real life experiences that are infused in these stories.
Absolutely.
And I thought that was brilliant. I was just like you know when you read something and you feel like someone is in the story, it's like, no, this is just not imagined in some ways, but yeah, there is a tentacle of reality.
Yeah, and that's for sure true. And it's interesting because, you know, I do that and like it's, you never know how much that's going to come off or not, but for sure it's true. And I mean, for me it's true, like, of kind of all the stories, but sometimes I think it's obvious because like I've really worked in the Lowe's home improvement truck. I've really worked in the mall for longer than I wanted. I really have a mom who said those things. I think using your own life as a source of like meaningful fictive like excavation is like important for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I spent a lot of time feeling as though like my life was too boring or something. I lived with an Iraq-Afghanistan war veteran when I was in the MFA program. And he had seen the whole world and he had like had literally the craziest life, you know. And at the time I had pretty much lived my whole life within probably 150 miles of where I was born. And I hadn't really, you know, I was like, well, my life just is boring. Like, you know, I don't have enough meaningful experience. But then I sort of started to understand that, you know, meaning is, it's so relative, and you don't have to, you know, necessarily, there's a universe in yourself,
yes,
in every person.
Yeah.
And if you're willing to, like, see that, you know, the world will kind of open up, or these stories will, and fiction will. So for me, it was important to sort of honor like the life I've had, like, you know, for example, and like people in my life, like my mom or my father. I think I was able to sort of tap into that as I sort of let go of sort of a kind of self-consciousness about the unspectacular nature of my life, I think.
You also do a lot of social commentary in the book. I feel like for me, every story that I read was sort of like, wow, okay. He's making us think about this. He's making us consider about this. There is a lot of social commentary around consumerism, but really connected with capitalism.
Yeah.
And I wanted you to talk more about that exploration. Like, you know, there are about two or three stories in the short story collection that speak about like the mall, but speak about consumerism and the harmful effect of capitalism.
Yeah. And again, I think it's an important thread of the book. I spent a lot of time working in the mall, and also I spent a lot of time feeling as though I didn't have enough money. And like that was sort of told to me also by the world, by the things that happened to us. And so I think something happened that where, like, you know, I'm seeing people buying the stuff, I'm seeing these people sort of clamor to purchase things, and I'm selling them these things that I myself can't buy. And I think it's switched in my brain that, you know, this maybe isn't right, you know, this isn't the way it should be. And that opens something up for me. I think capitalism is really good at getting us to conflate like love and things. I think marketing, for the most part, wants us to be like, if only you had this jacket, only you had this shirt, this pants, this car, this refrigerator, you would be happy. You would finally get to have love. You would finally do this, that, the other. And I think that's a very sinister sort of project that is built into the system. You know, that your self-worth comes from having things, and your ability or your worthiness to deserve happiness comes from the things you can purchase or buy or get. And I think especially when you don't have stuff, that gets really rough. And so for me, I think growing up, I sort of saw that and it hurt me, and I decided to sort of push back against it in some ways that I could.
And so you do this exploration by telling us that sometimes we literally are willing to step on people, we're literally willing to kill people in order to get what we want, and we're literally also able to destroy relationships and friendships in order to get what we want. And I thought that was so brilliant to think about capitalism as a system that breaks down certain things, whether it's humanity more greatly, but also like the relationships that we create at the mall, but like when it's time for Black Friday, who's gonna win what, and now we just don't care.
I absolutely think it puts a lot of pressure on people's personal humanity. I think capitalism like asks you to value yourself above all, and things above people. In South Africa, I've been thinking specifically about food. I went on that food tour. It kind of was like really good for me. I'm like, man, like I'm also realizing that in some ways, inaccessibility of food is sort of a requirement of capitalism, because it means like you have to have the sort of capital to even eat. When food is a thing that can be sourced, like comes from the earth, but like it sort of requires or asks you to sort of subscribe out that food part to like the machine, and once you do that, you're dependent. You know. So that basically the general inaccessibility of food kind of leads to like a dependency on the system, and then all of a sudden now look where now you're in this state where they get to create the terms of what it means to literally live. And so
in essence, like, you know, you need capital in order to access human dignity.
And it doesn't have to be that way, but it's like that's how it is. So I am super interested in basically like the world like realizing like capitalism is not sustainable, and it's hurting like everybody. But I don't say that stuff. The story of Friday Black, the reason why I finally became comfortable with being the title is I finally had this turn in the story where the protagonist realized he's also speaking like Black Friday, and he also is so determined to be the best at this thing so he can make his mother feel that he loves her through some coat, which is a thing I really did. I really want my mother a coat at this store I used to work at called Against All Odds. It sounds like really literary, and whatever. The store was called Against All Odds, legit. And so I'm not like outside of the system. I'm a part of it too. You know, I used to like do the whole Jordans thing, and I still like them. You know, if the right one comes out again. But it's just like having some sense of self awareness, because again, for me it really comes from not having and feeling really badly about that, you know. So how can I like sort of change what's broken here, and how can we not just keep on doing the same thing forever, you know? How am I, and especially as I travel and I see what the whole world is, you know, I'm seeing like, you know, it's a problem everywhere. I mean, the problem of capitalism, how it currently exists.
Thank you so much.
There is another, you know, I mean, it occupies a lot of writers, I think, like in settler colonies particularly. But the title story, the first story, the opening track of the album of the book, is about racism.
Yeah.
And I wanted us to talk about that. Like, that story for me was absolutely brilliant.
Yeah.
But also, it hurt.
Yeah.
It hurt. Like this is where we are as humanity. And I wanted you to talk about why you wanted that to be the first piece of work that people read.
Yeah. And it's very, again, very intentional. It was my first story, my first book, you know, so it's pretty much my introduction to the world.
Yeah.
And like I said it earlier, like, I kind of knew that, like, once I did that, like, I'm sort of like a race writer forever, maybe.
Yeah.
You know? which, like, and I think you might say, they might say, if you're black, that's kind of automatically they're going to try to make you that no matter what. But, like, it's like they can feel good about, like, yeah, no, that's what you want, right?
Yeah.
And it's not what I want, because to me, like, it's an unavoidable part of existing. And, so that story, it is pretty brutal, I think, in a lot of different ways, quietly and loudly, sort of visceral and kind of violent. And I needed it to be first because, one, I it's kind of like a litmus test if you can like kind of handle this book. Like, this is like, if you can ride this ride, you know, you maybe you'll be okay. And I think that was important. But also for me, really, I said, when I finished that book, I had this feeling like, you know what, I think this should be in the world, even if no one ever knows I did it, you know. And that they has since become kind of my lighthouse as a creative person. Like, is this story, is it about Nana Kwame Adjei-Brenya, like having people know who he is or whatever, and or is it about like something bigger than that? And once I feel it is about something bigger than that, I feel confident about pursuing it as a story, you know. And it took a long, oh my god, the amount of hours to try to get that story down, a long time over a couple of years, just figuring out myself. And I still don't know if I got it all the way right, you know, but I tried to say something really honest and true about the pressure of moving through the world as a black person, having to code switch, and having like your sort of life shaped by that sort of tucking in and shifting of yourself. What does that mean?
And also like the subtleties, right? So having to apply for jobs,
yeah,
and having a particular name, and that name already separates you and puts you as a particular person, so you can't get access to certain things because of the name you carry,
right?
So your blackness is even in your name.
Yeah. And I mean, it's really interesting thing. Being South African in general is such an interesting thing for me, because It's maybe one of the first times. Is this true? Like, it's one of the first times where like people see my name, they don't have that second of like, huh? You know, it's like it's not a thing.
Yeah.
And I've never felt that in my life, actually. Mm. You know. Mm. And so, because like there, it's almost like, okay. I make a joke that like my last name is an A, so I'm always the first in like the roll call for class, the roster. And so when I'm in a class, I can tell that it's just like, hey guys, I'm gonna mess up some names, so I just so you know. And they almost want to be like, it's me, like, cause like I'm here, you know, like, cause like they really spend a lot of time like making this name is so unfamiliar to them, making that person feel very comfortable. But yeah, so like, you know, I don't have it. My name is not like John Smith, so I can't. I have a friend named John Smith, so that's funny. And he's black too. But I can't pretend, you know. There's no chance, like, there's like, oh, maybe this guy's a white guy, you know.
Yeah,
even though I do the hi, how are you doing today, you know, I do the voice though. And so
you speak about the code switching, and I think that one of your other stories, which speaks about sports, also, you know, uncovers racism in sports, also uncovers those little subtleties about code switching, right? So you have the protagonist who's dating this particular person is like, why are you working in this area, you know what this thing is doing for us, right?
Yeah.
And it's connected, you know, the racism, all systems of oppression are connected. In some ways, it's like, well, I need to earn a living, and this is possibly the only place where I can earn a living.
Yeah.
But also, like, that story for me sort of highlights how, like, the systems of oppression continue.
Yeah. And it's built right into the thing again. Like, once they get you dependent, they can make you kind of do whatever they want. You know, and I'm thinking a lot about that in terms of the food accessibility, which is a new piece of it that I haven't thought about. I'm thinking about that specifically because I've been here.
Yeah.
I did that tour.
Yeah.
But like, you know, that's a big piece of it. The food and housing thing, food, housing, water, you know, those three things, if they make that part of, imagine, like, you know, if those things were like, just, if you're a human being, you're sort of guaranteed that on some level, like the whole thing would kind of break down, you know, because then you don't have to like, the kid just acts how you jump as high as you want because that thing. So I'm really interested in that. But yeah, they are absolutely connected. And part of my process of discovery is like realizing which parts am I still subscribed to. It's like when a part of, this is like a dumb way to think about it that I'm just thinking of now, but like a part of like my like sort of personal like development, I guess it's unlearning stuff.
Yeah.
But a way of unlearning though is like, you know those apps that like, or that like those like things you can buy that like go through like these subscriptions you don't even know you had, and
yes,
they cancel them.
Yeah.
Like, it's kind of like you're kind of doing that, because as if, you know, if you're like a male, you kind of have a lot of subscriptions you maybe didn't know you had. A straight male, like, you know, you, and a lot of shit that like you subscribe to that like was not great. You know, and you have to like do the hard work of like unsubscribe to this, and then like, you know, like that unlearning process. But there's like, again, there's ones that like you could think of where it's like you didn't even realize you were subscribed to, because a little more subtle, like, oh yeah, like, what the, like, why don't you have food, go just go do it. go to the grocery store.
Yeah.
And what does that mean when you have to go to the grocery store? And like that is a big deal too, you know, and all this stuff. Water. I mean, I'm thinking about water differently because of like the rules of the hotel. I'm thinking about how that's been, you know, like, or like the signage even. So anyways, I just been thinking a lot about that stuff.
You also do some fantastical work, literally like thinking about imagining different worlds.
Yeah.
But in these worlds, like you often think maybe if a world is fantastical, if it's set in the future, it's going to be different. But I think your work reminds us that things are not suddenly going to change because we imagine them differently. And I wanted to talk about that. Like, so in these new worlds that we're creating, why are they not new?
Yeah. I like to do the future thing because I can like sort of say, if we extrapolate realistically from where we're at right now, there's no reason to believe anything would be anything better. It'd be much worse, maybe. If we stay on this track. And sometimes that realization happens quicker than you think. Like, when I wrote this book, I didn't think the U.S., the American president, I don't even like saying his name that much. I didn't think the American president could become the American president.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, look what happened.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, it's like, then we use this space to imagine something much worse so that we can like try, you know. So yeah, so part of my process is like presenting a word a lot that seems a lot worse than the one we already have, but it's maybe just a little different.
Yeah.
But then hopefully what I hope is that we can like collectively then do the opposite. Let's imagine one way better. What does it look like? What would have to be, what do we have to unsubscribe from? What do we have to unlearn?
Yeah.
You know, because I don't, I'm terrified about what the future could look like, you know. I'm terrified for a lot of reasons. It's just in terms of like the literal degradation of the planet, but also like the callous sort of degradation of like human decency in America, anyways, especially.
And I think that's interesting, right? When we think about where America was almost 10 years ago, right?
Yeah.
You think about the booming idea of the first black president and how like it was hopeful and joyous.
Yeah.
And then 2016 happened and it's not hopeful and joyous, right?
No.
And thinking about like what you're saying, like we could be in a moment of hopefulness, but in the same way, the future is not better. The future is different and could possibly be worse.
Yeah.
And I liked that. For me, that's what Fight It Black did for me. It's like, well, actually, maybe we're just doing a brief history of what's currently happening.
Yeah. You know? That's what I should
look of what's currently happening.
That's what I think. That for me, that's a lot of what it is. Because, like, you know, I don't know the future. Maybe everything will magically get better. I'm sure it will. But it's like, let's just be honest about it. Like, you know, let's even be honest about it. Because I think there's a hesitance to be like, man, this world, for a lot of identities, a lot of bodies. And again, that's a hard thing for some people to admit. Because, like, if I use men, for example, like, it's hard for some of them, for us, sometimes to admit, like, just by virtue of birth, like on some level your life might be easier than for others. At a certain level it becomes super clear to me, but like, you know, some people don't like to admit that. Not that life isn't going to be easy altogether, because we've made life hard for everybody.
Mm.
But, you know, that's just a true thing. And so I hope that I am not like, I think my work is a little bit more like hopeful than I am, actually, you know. I think there is like a potential to do something, even though, like, even personally I do think, but it's this, there's just like unwillingness to even admit there's something that needs to be done, you know.
And I think particularly in the American context, and I think about the South African context, is that we have these conversations about like how bad the world is, how many bodies are literally being laid in the street, like how many people are dying, but we're still like, no, it's not that bad.
I mean, I guess it's such an interesting problem, because like there is like maybe a significant argument to be made about like this that I don't necessarily like agree with, that like we're in like the best time that's ever existed, you know. Some might say that, but to me it's like, it's like, because to the person who's living a certain life, whose brother that is in the street, or who is themselves the one laid on the street, like, good luck convincing them of that, you know. And I'm not, it's not like, and again, like, it's not like to say like, there's never been a worse time. Like, yeah, like, you know, there's been the bubonic plague. Doesn't mean we stop trying to develop medicine now, you know what I mean? Like, they're like, well, it's not the bubonic plague.
And also, I feel like in some instances, it's a cop-out argument, like when people are saying, like, things could be worse. Yes, yes, you are right, things could be worse, but they are bad currently.
And it's how so do annoying we... when people say that. Yeah, things could be worse. I could punch you in the face right now. That'd be way worse than it was before.
Still, like, I'm
but, like, you know, a lot could happen in a second.
Another story that was, like, fucked with my mind was the story about abortion.
Yeah.
It, like...
through the, Lark Street.
Yeah. And I was, like...
Yeah.
Hold up. Like, what is happening here?
Yeah.
And I want to talk about the process of the development of that story.
Yeah.
Because... It was brilliantly written.
Yeah.
Like, I was just like, yes, yes. But I wanted to know, yeah, you know.
Yeah, so for me, a big part of this, of getting to write that was just being like, no, that's, I mean, it's, I'm in this place where this is something I'm thinking about, but it's also sort of like taboo. I'm like not supposed to think about it or know about it, even as you may be like going through your, like, you know, being involved in it. And I tried to, but the challenge of it for me is, again, being like, this is a conversation that for years has unfortunately been dominated by men, and to be another male voice even saying anything about that, there's an inherent sort of problematic nature of that, which, mm-hmm, I fully acknowledge, I think. But I think what is important, and part of what I kind of realized in the story, is like this male protagonist is sort of like, is centering himself in this thing that's happened between him and his girlfriend, and sort of realizing, like, chill out, bro. Like, it's not like, it's not really about you. Thank you so much. Realizing that through writing the story actually was like an important piece for me, but also like just getting to the place where, like, you know, this is a thing, abortion is a thing, and America, you know, we're like about to go backwards in time in America,
yeah.
And it's like, no, we need to, like, I want this to be normalized. Actually, I really look forward to a time where, like, that story is like, oh yeah, like, I guess, you know, like you know, like, whatever, like, you know, where it's not like a big deal,
yeah,
you know. And I say it, and it's funny because, like, when I started talking about it, I talked about the sequencing. I put that story forth because I didn't want to, like, hide it. I didn't want to be like, let me, like, I did this, but I didn't. After I had that very intentional first three story sequence, and that was right there too, because it's like also this.
Yeah.
And I think that's just like me, the tip of the iceberg of exploring, like, sort of like a masculinity thing, and like there's so much more that can happen in that space for me, and I think I have a lot of room to grow there. But I think it was an important story for me to just try to write. I didn't want to run from it, you know. I thought it was a hard story to try to do, I did think that it was something that I wanted to try.
I'd like you to read just the first page, because I also think it's got like such a brilliant start. Like, mm-hmm, the way that it was so brilliant.
Thank you. Okay, this is just the very beginning of the story called Lark Street. An impossible hand punched my earlobe. An unborn fetus, aborted the day before, was standing at my bedside. His name was Jackie Gunner. So I guess you didn't have the balls, Jackie Gunner said. His voice was a stern squeak. My eyelids rolled open. He's a tiny silhouette at the end of my pillow, smaller than a field mouse. Well, say something, Dad. He said Dad the way some people say cunt. Do you even feel bad? Yeah, I said. I feel real bad, Jackie Gunner repeated. Is real bad a hole big enough to fit our lives in? Are, I said. It's a metaphor, Daddy, said a new voice. This one shy, charming even. A second tiny fetus climbed up on my comforter onto my bed. Her name was Jamie Lou. Phew, Jamie Lou said at the summit, which was up near my pillow. She plopped down so she was sitting beside Jackie Gunner. A tiny shadow beside a tiny shadow. Twins, I thought.
And you know what's interesting? Reading the story is like how...
I haven't read the beginning of that in a long time. Like, you know, wow. I'm like, yeah, there you go.
For me, reading the story was sort of like this male protagonist trying to center his life, whereas in effect his life did not change drastically.
Yeah.
Like, it stayed the same.
Yeah.
And he had a certain idea of what his future was, and he didn't want his future to be messed up. So placing this, his girlfriend, in a position where he thought she didn't make these decisions for herself, so he sort of wanted to push her to make these decisions.
And you know, and this, and the writing, that I feel like that's such a smart reading. I mean, I think that's really where I arrived at. But the writing thing is so cool because that's the story I revised over the course of like 6 years or something. One of the earlier stories, the first draft, mm-hmm. and I did a workshop day, and luckily, and my editor is a woman, my agent's a woman, and I had several women workshop it. And I'm like, the first version of the story, we're like, as if the narrator of the story wrote it, really without having made like the growth that he was doing it, where like, she really did like just have like some psychic, you know? It was like, it was really bad. And it kind of just took years of kind of growing up. And I guess like what I'm saying is that when I first tried to write a story like that, I hadn't unsubscribed from certain sort of like male centered views, yeah, and sort of unsubscribed from like my own like sort of idea about myself.
Yeah. So in some ways, the story helped you unlearn a couple of things.
For sure.
Yeah.
For sure. Yeah. So having to engage with the subject directly, and also having me like showing literally, you know, these are some women in my workshop, this is the thing I wrote, and then be like, okay.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
You know, and you're like, oh, and like, you know, if you're open to receive that kind of thing, and luckily, like, you know, the people in my cohort, you know, had some pretty great generosity of spirit to be like, let's sit this little boy down a little bit. And then I helped me kind of grow mentally, and also for sure to help the story become something better.
But I also think the protagonist was, he was a little weird for me.
Yeah.
Like, because I think that he hadn't fully come to terms with what was happening.
Yeah.
Although he knew a certain outcome would be good for his future, but it wouldn't be. So the interaction with the psychic for me was quite interesting.
Yeah.
Because it was like, well, I made you do something, so I'm not going to believe anything that you're going to say to me, because you know, people effectively just give you money,
yeah,
and they tell you to say what you want to say. So this is all bogus.
And I think he, you know, that kid is, you know, like doesn't know what he's doing. He's like overwhelmed.
Yes,
you know,
yes.
He's in. And I that's why reading the first thing, the first page is interesting, because he's like, yeah, I feel real bad. Like, you know, like even I feel real bad is like when I look at that sentence. Again, if like a protagonist that like is similar to like in my mind, like a person who would speak like me, like I feel real bad is not a thing I would ever say. So you know, it's like someone just saying like, him saying that way is like, just like an overwhelmed, like I don't know what to do kind of thing. But I'm just gonna like say what I think I'm supposed to say. But also, there's a sort of general science about this subject as a whole that I have had no guidance to like sort of learn this. That said, maybe what you know. Jacqueline also doesn't have the guidance, but she's sort of managing, she's figuring it out.
I'd like you to also read just the last two paragraphs, because I feel like it's just, this story was absolutely brilliant for me.
Okay, so, of course. And this is here, this is the girlfriend who I'm speaking with, the protagonist. Of course it wasn't, Jacqueline replied. She took a step closer and stared me in the eye. Disappointment reigned. Then she looked at her unborn children withering away in her hand. It's fine. I'll handle it. She said with only a small fraction of the sharpness she could summon. She turned and started walking. Can I help? I said. Maybe later, Jacqueline said, her voice tired but without malice. I watched her, then I started in the opposite direction. I walked, hoping I'd see her smile again. At home, I fell asleep on a pillow stained with blood.
Just absolutely, look, brilliant.
Yeah.
Brilliant, because it again describes what you're saying. She's like, I'll handle it, you know.
You just aren't ready. And like that, and again, like that's like, it's like kind of unfortunate, because it's like, you have to do this thing by yourself now, or like you have to do this other person just isn't emotionally whatever. But then, and I think the next thing for me to do is like, why are like men so like coddled into not being prepared to do anything the same way? And like women, it's like, you have to figure it out. Men, it's like, yeah, if you're not ready, like, go ahead, you know. But I think that, but for me, there was a truth in that, in that, you know, because that's what happens. And there's like, cause there's something weird about like having that be the view we're with, because it is like a, you know. But I, for me, it was like true, even if it was like kind of lost, a true kind of lost or ignorance kind of space.
And what do you hope for the book to do in the world now that it's out? What do you hope for it to do?
You know, it's always like sort of scary for me to like try to like project my hopes, but I do have some specific ones. I hope that helps some people that don't previously see themselves represented too much might feel represented and seen. I hope that someone working in a mall might and hates it might be like, you know what, this is, I'm not crazy, like this doesn't have to be this way. I hope that the new world order is brought about. No. Like, I hope that capitalism is toppled.
Yeah.
Not by this, but I mean, I hope that people sort of are trained to like remember you don't have to step on someone else's head, no matter how nice the TV is, you know? Like, and on a grander scale, basically to sort of be aware of like the sort of system that try to steal the humanity away from them, you know? Like, can like stop that, like you can like pick it, you can like maybe push back against that, and then more, I think the most thing I hope most is that people are willing to like engage with their own imaginations more, because I think that's a really key part of like shaping the world, like, you know, just be willing to imagine something different, like totally different, you know.
Honestly, when I finished read the book, that's what I saw. Yeah. I was like, wow, like Nana is causing us to imagine differently.
Yeah.
Like the current is not working for us, it hasn't been working for us, and we need, in order for us to survive, we need to imagine it differently. I mean, Alma and I speak about this a lot. Like, one thing we really enjoyed, it's like in some ways it's a call to action. It's like, you know, things are fucked up.
Yeah.
And like, we need to do something about it.
And yeah, it's like, you know, I think it can be radical. Like, it has to happen in your mind first. You have to be willing to be like, okay, this is what's in front of me. It can be totally different. And some people are willing to do that. And a lot of people are willing to do that, like owning within this framework that's already exists. But we can, like, we don't have to. We don't have to subscribe to general, like, you know, whatever you want to call it, heteronormative white patriarchy forever. Like, that doesn't have to be it.
Yeah, yeah.
And like, you know, and for me, like it doesn't really serve anybody. Even the people in those groups, like, you know, even it doesn't serve anybody.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
Like, I think about men, like, and when you go to one of these panels, and then like, you know, the obligatory like white guy gives like his awkward bad comment, and it's like, man, even this guy's being held back by the system, because like he just did a whole panel, like he couldn't even, you know, it's like we're all held back, we're all like, everyone is, and obviously those who are privileged, it manifests differently, but that's like, there's an internal thing that's happening with you that I'm scared of too, like, you know, like James Baldwin's like, you know, you've already done everything you can do for me, how are you gonna save yourself? Like, that's a real thing. But you know, I do think it's like possible, but it's just like, I guess as I go down this road, it gets, you know, it's kind of like you start seeing, you can't unsee it.
Yeah.
And then you start like, why are we all like seeing it? But I think we are, though. I think we're starting to are.
I hope so. Like, for everyone, for humanity's sake, I constantly think about Jimmy Baldwin, and I'm like, you know, when he wrote The Fire Next Time, he was just like, they have to see themselves. You know, they have to see themselves, because I think the problem is that they don't see themselves. So if they can't see themselves, how can they see us?
Yeah.
And in a way, your book does that. It's like, please see yourself.
Yeah.
Like, this is what is happening. See yourself.
And for me, it's really important to be like, not just like me too. You know what I mean?
Yes.
I worked so crazy on the Black Friday weekend, because I was like, man, if I get my mom a North Face, you know, then I'm a person. Then I get to be like a real person, like y'all. And I got her that North Face, and it doesn't fit her anymore, which is like an apt metaphor for something, you know? I got her that North Face, and so what?
Where is and it so now? What? Yeah, and so what? I wanted to talk a little bit about like some of the writers that inspire you. I know we spoke about that at the beginning.
Yeah.
Who are some of the other writers that really inspire you? Who do you return to often?
Reread Sula just now.
Yes.
So obviously, you know, that's the main high goddess of all, Toni Morrison. And you know, I'm pretty sad about her passing, but you know, she's given us so much. All we can do is be grateful.
Yeah.
So that's huge. She's huge for me. I think she's underrated how funny she is. You know, she's really like harsh and like an option on the sentence level, like incredible. But like her dialogue is like super, like bam, bam, bam. You know, I was thinking about that. Like, I don't like. Anyways, whatever. Everyone knows she's the best. So she's spectacular. Like I said, George has always been a big deal for me, because again, not being afraid to be really funny and kind of irreverent and say, and also like on the nose with a mission. Like, he clearly has a mission, like, you know. And he, when he did the when they published like his little college speech, which he gave at Syracuse, it was like, be kinder. Like, that's his thing. Like, kindness is like his brand. And to do that on a high level, where I think literary world is sometimes sort of like scoffs at like that sort of sincerity, mm-hmm. is a very impressive thing to me. Like, to be like kindness, because I try to move that way, or I try to get better at that, because it's important. I don't know, I think it matters. So Toni Morrison, George Saunders,
You spoke about Jimmy, which you spoke of him with familiarity, so I think you commune with him too.
First, I absolutely do. I teach Sunday Blues almost every class I teach.
Mm-hmm.
Just because, you know, someone who was really going in and trying his best, and wasn't afraid. I like Ishmael Reed. Ishmael Reed was a big deal for me. Mm-hmm. I have a first edition copy of Mumbo Jumbo because my agent got it for me. And it was really cool. Yeah, it's super dope gift. And like the story, like that book helped me write Finkelstein 5.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, people like this who aren't afraid to just do something weird. And I guess I like the ones who are accepted while they do it.
Yeah.
Because like everyone isn't, like, you know, like George writing the stuff he writes, like, it's not obvious that would catch on, you know? It's weird. His stuff is weird. It's not standard. But that's the funny thing. When you catch on and you do your own thing, now you're a stylist.
Yeah,
you
know? That's true. That's definitely true. And I want to talk a bit about, like, what can we expect more from you? I mean, we're still enjoying Friday Black, but is there anything else that you're working on?
Yeah, I'm working on a novel codenamed Top Secret Novel. That's a joke I make too much. But I am working on a novel where... I'm not even sure if it's a secret or not with that adaptation stuff. I'm adapting. Even while I was here, I was doing some script stuff. So we're trying to adapt some of the stories in this for television.
Mm-hmm.
And then so I'm working my novel first. And I have a lot of another short story collection too, actually, secretly. Mm-hmm. As I say, it's a publicly podcast thing. But yeah, I have a lot of stuff like in the I have a lot of work to do. You know, we all have a lot of work to do, I guess. But yeah, for sure. Next thing will be a novel, though.
Okay. But thank you so much, Nana.
Thank you. That was great.
Like, for Friday Black.
Thank you so
like,
much.
Like, it's been absolutely amazing. So at the Cheekinators, we do something exciting, I suppose, for people who don't know. Like, our listeners obviously wait to the end part of the podcast.
Okay.
Because what we do is, we're in the business of reparations. So we give our authors, instead of 5 stars and, you know, uh-huh. all these popcorns, we're like, no, we want to give you land.
Oh.
Because land is prime real estate, right?
Okay.
So, I mean, you're in South Africa. This is your first time in South Africa. We are in the lush Cape Town.
Yeah.
So I don't know how you feel about beaches, but there's absolutely, you know, prime real estate beach called Clifton.
Clifton?
You know, Clifton.
Okay.
And so we're going to give you a plot, you know, a private beach in Clifton for you to, you know, write your second novel and write the short story collection, because, like, that's what you deserve for this amazing work that you do with the podcast.
So where is it?
No, it's just like a good chew, obviously.
Where should go. Okay, I'm going to try to go there. And it's called Clifton?
Clifton. It's called the Clifton Beach. Hi, guys.
Hi.
Amma has just arrived, like, at the tail end of this conversation.
Gosh, yeah, guys.
Do you want to say anything to Nana before we go down? Do you want to say anything about Friday Black?
Oh my God! So somebody described this book. You know, in something you read something that you wish you'd written. Somebody described. I read Roxane Gay's review of this book. That's how I initially knew that I wanted to read this book. And somebody described this book as black political dystopian fiction. And I don't know, I feel like Nana's just inventing his own genre of writing. There's levels to this thing. So, yeah, so I was going to say, like, this book has been such a powerful read. I think that we are looking at ourselves in different ways. We're writing ourselves in different ways. And this book is so hard-hitting. Like, there's so many powerful themes. I know that Klokonolo just expanded on all of them.
Yeah.
But themes of, like, racism, what it means to have the boots of capitalism against your neck as a black person in this world every day and have your sense of worth just commodified, right, at the lowest price. And I think Friday Black is asking all the right questions. I think Friday Black is also answering some of those questions. But yeah, power to a new genre. I really felt like I was reading a new, different kind of genre. So I'm quite sad that I missed the conversation. But I know that one day the Cheeky Natives will have a jet.
Yeah, and we can fly all over the world.
These problems of mine will be, but also don't let your kids go to med school.
Thank you guys so much. That was very humbling. I'm trying, like, I feel generally very sensitive. So, like, I don't want to start crying right out of nowhere. So, but I was going to say thank you. It was very humbling for me. Like I said, I feel very, like, I don't know. My parents, both being African themselves, they're Ghanaian, and my father, he passed recently. Like, for this to be my first time here, and like to be here in this way, it's like, if I think about it too much, I start crying. So I'm not going to. But I am beyond humble. So it means a lot to me. It really means a lot to me.
And before we sign off, where can people get a hold of you? Social medias, where can we get a hold of you?
Yeah, I do the social media thing, I guess. On Instagram, what is my Instagram? I want to say it's KingNK, like King_NK on Instagram, and then on Twitter, it's NK_ADJEI, like my name. But yeah, I'm pretty bad at corresponding, but I'm also getting, like, once in a while, I'm like, I'll eventually get to everyone, but I'm pretty slow at it. And I get overwhelmed easily, as you can see. But I am there, so if people want to reach out, it's very nice for me. But I mean, honestly, like, everything already is, like, pretty cool.
And once again, thank you from the Cheeky Natives. We really enjoyed your work, and we look forward to having you back for the mini books that you will write with our private jet. So thank you very much, Nana.
Thank you, guys. Yay. Yeah.